Hi, this is Barry, and welcome to Simplicity Zen. Today, my guest is Ruben Abato Roshi. Ruben Abato is the founding teacher of the Maria Kanon Zen Center. He is a former Jesuit priest and now a Zen teacher practicing in the Sambo Zen lineage, which was founded by Yasutani Roshi in Japan. He received Dharma transmission from Yasutani's heir, Yamada Koun, in 1988. He is a faculty member at Southern Methodist University, Perkins School of Theology, where he teaches world religions and spirituality and directs the Spiritual Foundation program. How are you doing today?
I'm okay, thank you. We have fine weather in Dallas, and it's a little on the chilly side.
Yeah. It's been a year of temperature extremes all across the country so far.
And roller coaster also.
Yes. Well, cool. I'm really glad to interview you today. I've actually gotten a couple requests to interview you, so I appreciate you.
Thank you. I'm honored. Thank you.
Yeah, your willingness to do this. So right now you're active faculty at the university?
Correct. I teach courses on interfaith studies, teaching students who are preparing to serve in Christian ministry. Mm-hmm. About other religions, and of course the main other religion that gets the most time and coverage would be Buddhism. So I cover Buddhism from its foundations, or its background in Hindu culture and religion, and then look at the life of the Buddha, and then through the development through the centuries, through the different cultures and so on. And then we of course, we have to cover other religious traditions like the so-called Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Well, we don't do much of Christianity because that's what they're already getting in their other courses. So how to see what is good in other traditions in a way that Christian pastors or Christians who are preparing to serve in ministry may be able to see that they're not the only game in town, for one, and that they can learn from other traditions. And especially regarding Buddhism, I'm also introducing Buddhism in a way that they can take it as a practice more than a set of beliefs. And so in that regard, I find many who are receptive to it. And so they can be enriched in their own life of contemplative practice as they encounter the way it has been done and the way it has flourished in people's lives. Or the way it's made people's lives flourish in Buddhism. So so I enjoy doing my work here, and they even pay me for it. So I'm very grateful.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Is it the Southern Methodist that recently broke off from the other Methodists over gay marriage? Or is that a different group?
Southern Methodist University is a it was founded by the Methodists about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now it's, although there is a Methodist bishop on the board of trustees, I believe that it has its own set of principles for providing education. Mm-hmm. And so the Methodists are now in a process of really struggling with their identity, especially with regard to LGBTQ acceptance or non-acceptance in the ordained ministry and so on. So the ones who are in the school where I'm teaching at will be the more open ones, who are more welcoming of different kinds of people. And so anyway, many of the Methodists seem to be really struggling with that, and many churches are separating from what is known as the United Methodist Church. So it's soon going to be the Divided Methodist Church. Anyway, that's the background. But and so the persons who come to our school are now going to have to discern where they will be in terms of the division, and it's also going to affect the enrollment and so on. But in any case, that's where, there's a lot of religious turmoil within the Methodist Church now.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys, is it all God, I'm spacing on the word, the opposite of Catholic, or I don't know if that's right. It's a real basic word that I'm spacing on. You know, Martin Luther, like, nailed a letter on the,
right.
What's that term for that?
Yeah.
What is it?
The Protestant movement.
The Protestant, thank you. Is it all Protestants going through your thing, your program, or is it all do also Catholic priests?
Oh, some Catholics come so that they can also get credentials for chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. So it's an ecumenical school, you could call it that way. Maybe that was the word you were looking for. It's ecumenical, meaning various denominations of the different Christian churches, or even those so-called non-denominational churches can send students here, and we try to present the broad Christian tradition in a way that people can at least identify with the larger current of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Is it a graduate program or an undergraduate program?
It is a graduate program.
Yeah. Cool. So you grew up in the Philippines, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah. My father received a scholarship to go to Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, where he got his doctorate. And so we lived there for 2 years when I was in my grade school, grade 4 and grade 5. Mm-hmm. So I had a kind of a taste of American culture at that point, watched those TV shows in the 50s and so on. So I'm familiar with that part of U.S. life also. So then mm-hmm. I went back to the Philippines, entered the Jesuits there. And then in my 20s, I was sent to Japan, and I spent 20 years there. So that's where I learned about Zen and began practicing there.
Did you grow up as a Catholic?
Oh, yes, I did. And I still am a practicing Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Grub, are you speaking Spanish or Philip? Is that the name of the language? Or
the main language that I speak, started speaking as a youngster, is Tagalog, or they call it Pilipino, which mm-hmm. is so-called national language. But there are about, they say there are about at least 90 different kinds of languages in my country. And there are about 10 main ones that mm-hmm. are called dialects. But in any case, Tagalog is the main language I spoke growing up, and then learned English from grade school on. And of course, my being in the U.S. in St. Paul, Minnesota for 2 years in grade school also just gave me that kind of grounding in English.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever have any doubt about the existence of God or belief or anything like that? Or were you just kind of all in from the beginning?
That's a good question, and that's a good starting point, I think, of what I can relate about my Zen life. I was in senior high school then in the Philippines, and listening to a class in Elizabethan poetry or something to that effect. I believe we had to take all sorts of courses that were patterned after an American curriculum, since the Philippines was under American colonizers for 50 years after having been under Spanish colonizers for 300 years. So anyway, we had a very heavily American-accented high school curriculum, and we knew more about U.S. history than about Philippine history, I could even say. But in any case, I was not really listening to that lecture on Elizabethan poetry, but it was a beautiful day, and so I was just looking at the window outside. And as I looked at the white clouds and then the clear blue sky that somehow just went into what I imagined was an infinite horizon, something struck me. I had been reading a lot about physics and the dimensions of the universe and so on, and was attracted to astronomy and also to Einstein's theory of relativity and so on. And so I had heard or had read somewhere, and it stuck in my mind, that the universe is not an amorphous, straight infinity, but somehow has a curvature to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you flash a beam of light from any point of the universe, it looks straight when it goes up, but actually that beam of light will curve, and after gazillions and gazillions of light years, whenever that may be, that light beam will come back to its place where it's being flashed. So that's the structure of the universe based on Einstein's calculations. So my vague recollection tells me. So with that in my mind, I then imagine that. Oh, imagine a flash of light from here and then going through, and then it'll come back. And then I somehow began to think that, well, the universe is complete and integral and interconnected with all the principles I had also been reading in physics. So with that, there's no room for or no need for an outside principle like a God with white whiskers looking down at the world and managing the world and so on. So that image of God that I had been somehow assuming in my head when I would pray and so on as a Catholic, somehow just poof, vanished. And now I could see an interconnected universe, and the principles work, and everything still works. Trees grow, babies are born, dogs and cats do their dog and cat thing, and so on. The universe continues. And somehow the need for an outside power running all of this like puppets somehow disappeared from my mind.
Mm.
So I felt a sense of exhilaration. Ah, it's a wondrous universe after all, without a second level where there's grandfather God in the sky controlling everything.
Mm-hmm. Would you say this was like a perceptual shift, or is it more like an intellectual inspiration?
Somehow something shifted in me. I don't know whether I can distinguish it as an intellectual or as a more of an attitudinal thing, but somehow there I felt that it was refreshing. And at the same time, then what happens to God that I had believed in and I had prayed to and so on? So that was a kind of a crisis for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I then was spurred to continuing to ask those questions. Does God exist? And if so, what are the consequences for our human life and so on? No longer that grandfather in the sky that I used to imagine. But so there was a refreshing freedom, but yet also there was a gap that came into my life with that. And so then my search began. And so I happened to be, or rather at that point, I was in my senior year, and I was offered to undergo some exams. The National Science Board was inviting high school students to take this national exam so that they could give scholarships to 20 people from all over the country, who would then be given full scholarships, a full ride, plus a stipend to go to our state university, the University of the Philippines, mm-hmm. major in physics, chemistry, the sciences, so that those groups would be the leading scientists who would bring our country up from its situation to a level of scientific development. So I happened to be selected among those, and so I got a free scholarship to take on a Bachelor of Physics degree at the University of the Philippines, where I went the following year.
Interesting.
So with that, then I somehow gravitated to the Catholic Action, Student Catholic Action Center. There was a chapel there, and there were Jesuits who were coming to offer mass and religious services there. So I hung around with student Catholic Action students who love to eat, pray, laugh, sing together, and so on. We formed a group called the ELPS, the ELPS, Eating, Laughing, Praying, Singing kind of group. And so that's, in addition to taking my courses in the main part of the university, then all my break time, I would go to the Catholic Center and hang around with this group of students. And so I got into conversations with some of those who were more senior and who had also been asking those questions, who had been reading books on the existentialists, like Dostoevsky or Sartre and so on, or Thomas Aquinas. I got into that kind of circle where we talked about those things, and that made me more fascinated. I need to really explore this more. Mm-hmm. So I got somehow bored with my physics assignments and neglected my mathematics homework, but I spent hours in the library reading philosophy and books on religion and so on. I also read books by Spinoza and so on, in addition to the existentialists. And so that felt like something I wanted to do and give more time to. So it so happened that I was invited to a joyride by a friend who had a car, and there were two among the young ladies who were part of that Catholic Action group who also were free that afternoon. So, hey, let's go. Let's drive to the beach or to the Manila Bay, which is about 40, 45 minutes drive from the campus of the University of the Philippines. So on the way back, the friend who owned the car said, well, I have to drop by and at the Jesuit house because I have an appointment with Father so-and-so. So would you please wait for me while I check in with Father so-and-so? So he drove the car into the Jesuit compound, and he visited this priest whom he had an appointment with. And the two girls that we were with also had, let's visit Father so-and-so who comes to our university every now and then to say mass, and let's just say hello. So they did, and I was left alone. And then whom did I happen to meet but Father Benigno Mayo, who was then the person in charge of vocations, instead in charge of recruiting young Jesuits or young men to enter the Jesuits. And so I got to a conversation with him, and he looked at me and said, well, we have very high standards, you see. We don't just admit anybody. They have to prove that they can be intellectually capable, and that also that they have this endurance, and that they can really go the full course.
How did you guys even get on that conversation? Did you ask him? Were you thinking about the priesthood at that point? Or?
Not yet. Not at all.
Yeah.
So I knew that was a very honorable way of life. Uh-huh. But then the way he presented it to me was, well, we have to study a lot, and we have to really know these things about the existence of God and so on. That's part of our curriculum.
Theology.
Twice as long as a Jesuit than other groups like the diocesan seminarians to be able to study, because you have to really prepare yourself to serve others. And so that somehow attracted me, that I could be doing that kind of reading and thinking that I was already passionate about by being a Jesuit. So that was my first attraction to being a Jesuit, the intellectual life, the search for the answers to those questions of meaning or the existence of God or the purpose of human beings and so on. So I felt that that was where my heart was leading me to. So I asked, can I apply? And so, he said, let's see. You have to have 4 interviews and so on, and go through all of these tests and so on, psychological tests. So somehow I made it, and within 2 months I was accepted, and I was in the Jesuit novitiate, just open-minded and open-hearted.
So were you open with him about your doubts and the belief of
Sure, I had God in that in a bracket. I'm open, and yet I was also continuing to go to mass and so on. And it's not that the doubt did not mean no. It was not a very active doubt wherein you don't exist anymore. But my reading gave me that sense that Of course, there is that possibility. But if there is a God, it's not the old grandfather in the sky that I used to imagine. It has to be something different that I could really understand to be worthy of that title of God. And I was in search for that precisely. So right. By entering the Jesuits, I felt that it was going to give me the opportunity to search for that, which I had been seeking, which I had been calling God, but which no longer applied to that those images I had before.
So that experience you had in the classroom, do you think there was a kind of an intuitive sense of like kind of the Dharmakaya, absolute reality? Was there that aspect to it?
Looking back, and if you use that term, although I only learned that term many years later, somehow I could agree that it's that flash of truth, the Dharma, shines through in different forms that somehow touched me, or I was touched by it, such that, well, anyway, to divert, what allowed me to do all of this and still remain within the Catholic fold was that in 1965, the Second Vatican Council had been going on since 1962. So in 1965, they issued this document called Nostra Aetate, which is also called the Document on Non-Christian Religions from a Catholic Perspective. And it's stated there explicitly that wherever there is truth and goodness and holiness, or whatever is true and good and holy in this world comes from the same God that we worship in our Christian tradition. And so with that, somehow that was liberating to realize that if something is true, then it's what the Catholics also believe, whether it comes from the Hindu tradition or Buddhist tradition, or whether it's something that an atheist physicist discovered and so on. If it's true, then that must also come from God. So that at least liberated me into thinking of God as precisely that which is true without exactly being able to define it at that point. So that gave me the lead. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, as Jesuits, we were trained early on in the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, where we undergo a month-long period of silence and self-reflection in a very methodical way according to the guidelines of St. Ignatius. And that was really a powerful experience that enabled me to encounter something whereby now I could use that term and be able to name it without understanding everything, but still have a sense that there was a presence, a protective and loving presence that I wanted to respond to by living also in a way that would be worthy of that love. So anyway, that was a formative experience for me, the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius.
Did you, you were a young man, did you have any doubt about giving up prospects for having a wife and children? And
oh yeah, that was all already out of my horizon. I said, this entire celibacy, and I'll take it. I made my vows to be celibate, to obey the superiors, and to live a life of simplicity and poverty. That's the threefold vow of the Jesuit.
And also, do you take a vow of obedience as well?
Correct, yes. Whoever is placed as your superior, whether it's the superior of the residence that you're living in, who is then subject to the so-called provincial superior, the one who is head of the Jesuits in the Philippines, who is also subject to the general in Rome, the general of the Jesuits in Rome. At that time, there are about 36,000 Jesuits throughout the world. And that general of the Jesuits is ultimately subject to the Roman, to the Pope of the Catholic Church, to the Holy Father. So it's a kind of a hierarchical obedience, and that's what I vowed myself to. Mm-hmm. To obey what I'm told by my superiors.
Was there any sort of contemplative prayer as part of your training?
Oh yes, that was
on that 30 days.
Yes, not just those 30 days. Right from the second day, or we were given orientation, and then right from the second day of our entry, we were already given instructions on how to sit in meditative or contemplative style for 1 hour each day, and also to live the rest of the day in a kind of a mindful attention to the fact that God is present, and so to recall that presence in our day-to-day life.
In the contemplative prayer, are you giving something to like focus on, or is it just like the equivalent of shikantaza where you're just like, kind of sitting there?
Or you would usually be given scriptural passages, mm-hmm. like Jesus said this, love your neighbor as yourself. So let that be your theme. And so you sit with that for one hour and so on.
Almost like a koan then.
Exactly, yes. Or scenes in the life of Jesus and mm-hmm. so on. Or there was a difference between so-called meditative practice and contemplative practice. The meditative practice consisted in more intellectual inquiry, or like an examination of my past and looking at where I have erred in my ways, or whether this or that conforms to what God wills of me and so on. So it's an examination that involves a lot of soul searching, so to speak. The intellect is also brought in
the meditative part, right? That you're describing right now, or is this the
the meditative part, just like in Descartes used that title for his musings on do I exist and so on. Mm-hmm. He called it meditations, and so also the famous one of Marcus Aurelius called Meditations. Really, it's really ruminations on things. Mm-hmm. Using the intellect to try to make comparisons or to explore or to make inquiries. So that also had a part in St. Ignatius' method. But after a while, after exhausting that, or after seeing some of the basic issues and you're now able to find a place of stability with that, then he brings us to the contemplative aspect of the exercises. And now you just sit back and behold. Mm-hmm. That's what basically contemplative practice in the Christian tradition means, to just behold. It comes from a Greek word, theorein, which means to see, to behold, to see clearly, to see with pure eyes so that you can see God, according to, the scriptures in John's Gospel, the fourth Gospel. So it's that way of opening one's heart to see things, to see the things of God, or to see things from the perspective of God. So that's also something that the exercises of Ignatius ushered me into. Mm-hmm. And these exercises conclude with a contemplative practice called contemplation on God's love. So we are guided to just sit there and behold the things around us, like trees or flowers or the land or dogs and cats, and see each and every one of these things as enveloped in that unconditional love of God. And mm-hmm. see yourself also as enveloped in that unconditional love. And just sit there and bask in that.
Just like a somatic exercise almost.
Also, yes, somatic, and also very concrete way of mm-hmm. including everything that you can sense. So, yeah, Ignatius is also keen on using the senses to lift them up into that divine plane. So in that regard, it's really a very powerful experience to undergo these spiritual exercises if you're given the right guidance. So that somehow is the pivotal point in my life, where now I feel that the only way to live is to live according to this love and offer myself to be able to love in return.
Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know now, you know, and understanding Buddhism stuff, looking back, do you think that kind of practice brought you into any samadhi states?
I can say I don't have any clear instances when I remember that samadhi, but somehow it was a gradual transformative process whereby you get touches of that sense of the divine or sense of the holy. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a second or so, or a few more minutes or so, and so on, somehow there is a transformation that goes on in one's inner being in mm-hmm. that process. So just a glimpse, for example, and you behold it, and you're just left in awe at something that you meet there.
Mm-hmm. So you've described all this in pretty positive terms. Did you ever go through like a dark night period through this process or anything like that?
The dark night came later when I then, there were a couple of those when I began to question everything that I had ever learned at that point and so on. I can tell you more about that later. Okay. But Yeah, we'll get to that. The dark night came when everything collapses, and then you are left only with that sheer trust in moving forward. Mm-hmm. But that came later. So anyway, with that in the background, then I, to make a long story abbreviated at this point, somehow 5 or 6 years into the Jesuits, while I was studying philosophy in Loyola School of Theology in the Philippines in Quezon City, somehow I felt that I could, that I felt attraction to go to Japan to serve as a Jesuit there. And the person who gave me that idea was Father Robert Kennedy, who is now the Zen master in New Jersey. Anyway, he had just been ordained a couple of years at that point when I was still a novice, a newly minted Jesuit, just in my training. And he came to visit the Philippines, and he gave a talk to the novices talking about Japan and how Japan is now a very economically successful country, and it's losing its spirit. So we need people to really help in the work of the church there to attract more people to the faith and so on. So he gave this plug about...
Was he a Zen student at this point?
I'm not sure whether he had already begun then, but he was just a young, newly ordained priest in his 30s, I believe, at that point. Mm-hmm. I was just about to turn 20. So anyway, that attracted me. But then I brushed it off saying, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the Philippines also. But he planted a seed then, and several years later, when I was doing my philosophical studies, somehow I got exhausted by my studies after final exam. So I asked for a week to just come back to the novitiate, to the place where I began my Jesuit life in the countryside, and just took time to rest, sleep a lot, just eat regularly, and then took walks in the garden. And it was during that time that something struck me. Why not go to Japan? They have a need of Jesuits there. So somehow that became very attractive, and so I followed it up with a letter to the general in Rome. And he said, well, you're still young. Go ahead, continue with one more year and do your internship, what we call regency, where I was sent to teach philosophy at the Ateneo de Manila University. So teaching
in the Philippines?
Correct, yes. Undergraduate students in philosophy. And I loved that also. Mm-hmm. So after 1 year, then the letter came again saying, well, since you applied, now it's ready, you can now go. So then...
Did you know anything about Buddhism or Zen at this point?
Yeah, I had heard about it. I had... I had read some works of D.T. Suzuki and so on. And I had some vague knowledge, but I did not really plan on doing any Zen until I got to Japan. I was in the language school in Kamakura. And my spiritual director, a Jesuit in his 50s at that time, had also been going to Yamada Kōen Roshi's Zendo already. Mm-hmm. But I knew he was doing that. But what began my interest in Zen was an invitation by a student whom I had been coaching in English, who coached me in Japanese in return. So we had this exchange of 1 hour each on an afternoon, a weekday afternoon, where he coached me in my Japanese while I coached him in his English. And he told me, he came one day and said, hey, there's this discounted Zen weekend retreat for students. It's 1,000 yen for the whole weekend. That means about $10 or so. Mm-hmm. And you get your meals and a two-night stay there in the Zendo. So I felt, maybe might as well. I'm trying to learn about Japanese culture, so might as well learn through this practice.
What monastery was this?
Engakuji.
Okay.
That is the monastery in Kitakamakura, just one station away from where the language school was.
Rinzai, right?
Yes, it's Rinzai. And it was, it had Well, it had so many monks who were preparing to be the head priests of the temples throughout the nation. So it's one of those big Rinzai training monasteries.
Yeah, Dojo Sama. Essentially like a seminary in a lot of ways.
Correct, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, they conducted this free, or not free, but this discounted Zen retreat for students. So I went there that Friday afternoon and was ushered into a room, and there were about 100 or so young people, young men and women.
Mostly Japanese?
Practically all Japanese. And they were being given the instructions by the monks, and the monks had their sticks and so on. So we had to wake up at 3 o'clock, be on our tan, on our seat by 3:20 after doing the washing and everything else we needed to do to prepare, and then just be in our seats when they had the inspection, the kentan. And then after a couple of hours of that, there was breakfast, and then a talk by the master then, and then some more chores, and then more sitting and so on. So anyway, Sunday morning when we were about to finish, I felt a lot of aching bones and aching joints and so on. But somehow there was this very exhilarating feeling that this is something I want to do again. But not immediately. Wait a little bit. But in any case, I came home with those aches. But somehow it left a very attractive taste in me that that's a kind of intense silence that I'd like to do some more of. So when my spiritual...
Sorry to interrupt. Did they give you any instructions what to do with your mind during the sitting?
Just basically just count at that point. Basically, okay. We did not have anyone on. Oh, yeah. No, did I have a one-on-one? No, there were too many of us for the Zen master to be able to meet us individually. So we were just given general instructions. So just keep your mind focused on your breath and count your breath with the out-breath and so on, just basic things like that. Mm-hmm. So that experience was my real first taste of Zen, a whole weekend.
Did you have a basic understanding of Buddhism prior to this? Did you understand like the Four Noble Truths and
not quite yet at that
any
time.
Of that? No,
I said I just got interested after that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. So what did that experience at the monastery? Did it feel distinctly different from your, you know, contemplative
exercise? Yeah. Well, somehow it was simpler. Somehow it's just a matter of sit there, be aware of your breath, and let your mind rest.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the contemplative exercises that I learned through the Ignatian Way had all of these instructions on theological angles and so on. There was a lot of verbal explanation of how to get there. Mm-hmm. Whereas this one was simply sit there, breathe with awareness, and just let your mind be still. And somehow I like that.
Yeah.
And so then, so when I, after several weeks of the orientation that was required by the San Un Zendo, where I had now applied to join, then I was introduced to Yamada Kon Roshi in Shoken, the first formal meeting in Doksan. And he immediately gave me the Koan Mu right there.
Did you, had you heard about him previously? You must have.
Only through my spiritual director, who said, "Oh, there are many people coming from Europe and from the United States to practice Zen here because his name is now getting to be well known there as a very good and very helpful and very open-minded Zen master." You see, the difference was Yasutani Roshi, his own teacher, kept insisting that you have to leave your whatever religious faith or religious beliefs you have. You have to leave them at the door and enter into the Zendo and be open to being a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. He said, unless you do that, then you cannot really experience the Dharma. So from some people's perspectives, those Christians, there were already some priests and some Protestant ministers and even Catholic nuns who had been coming to sit at that point, were regarded by some of the older Buddhists as doing Gedo Zen, the Zen for outsiders. They can't really be they're not really Buddhist, but they're practicing Zen for some spiritual benefit of theirs, and that's fine, but they can't really get into the heart of Zen. Mm-hmm. But Yamada Kōun somehow did not say you should leave your religious beliefs at the door. He said, there may be some things in there that can point you to that wordless dimension of Zen. So he said, I can give you verbal instructions in Zen as a Buddhist, because that's where I come from, and I am a Buddhist that uses Buddhist terminology. And what I would like you to experience is that realm beyond words and letters. And once you have experienced that realm, you know that you can use different kinds of words and letters to point that to people whom you will be guiding. So, anyway, this is something that he said already years ahead, years on, when I was already also well into the Zen practice. Mm-hmm. And he said he told those of us who were from other traditions who had been sitting with him, when you go back and people look at you, look to you as guides in contemplative practice, learn how to use your own scriptural vocabulary and your own theological terms so that you can guide the people who use those terms towards that experience that is beyond concepts and beyond words. Mm-hmm. Please go ahead and learn your own tradition so that you can use the words there to help others in guiding them towards the Zen experience and towards letting the Zen experience mature in their lives, even with the use of those terms. So that was his kind of challenge to those of us who came from other traditions, mm-hmm. especially the Christians.
What was your first, had you read Three Pillars of Zen at this point?
Yes, at that point, that was what we who were non-Japanese were always told to do in the orientation talks. So read Three Pillars of Zen and you'll get all you need in preparation, and then you're ready and so on.
What was your first impression of him in the Dokusan room?
I felt his warmth and his way of really affirming and welcoming people in his heart. So I already felt attracted, like a spiritual father, so to speak, someone whom you could really be open to and trust and follow.
Mm-hmm. Was he like, you know, different teachers have different demeanors in the room. It sounds like some are very strict and like brusque. Some are more open and soft. It sounds like I don't know if that's a real continuum, but you know, where would you say he was?
He was on the kinder side. Mm-hmm. It would take a little more time in Doksan to hear more about the background rather than just saying, you don't get it, okay, sit some more, which mm-hmm. I heard is also a style that is helpful for some teachers, but that was not his style. His style was to really lean forward and let himself hear what the practitioner was all about. But of course, when it came to koan work, he could also be very, very clear and straightforward. Oh, okay, you don't get it. Come back and sit again. But you always felt that even when he said that, there was something in his heart that embraced you and wanted you to go deeper rather than being a kind of a strict word that just wants to put you up against a standard.
Mm-hmm. How did being assigned mu change your practice?
That really became another explosive experience that made me think, I really don't need all of these Christian terms and words and so on. Why do I have to remain a Christian? I had that kind of crisis. Mm-hmm. So then I was then studying theology in preparation for ordination to the priesthood. So that became a crisis in a sense. And yet somehow I felt that doing that was not really in jeopardy, but for me it was, why the need for all of this verbiage and all of this theological stuff when it can be arrived at so simply, not in so many words, but by just telling people to sit, be aware, and let your mind rest in that stillness. Mm-hmm. I had to sort that out myself, and I had to work through what these theological terms mean in a way that I could also understand them in the light of my Zen practice. Mm-hmm. So again, it took me years to be able to really come to terms with that and know that, yes, there's also something here that I can uphold and can also integrate in my own life and spirituality, and then be able to share my own Zen experience with people through this conceptual framework. Mm-hmm.
Did you do a lot of sesshin?
Oh, yes. In the beginning, I would do at least two a year. And then, I think I did about twice a year through the years, even when I was in graduate school. And then, that's not a lot for some for Soto standards, I suppose. But at least that's what I could muster, mm-hmm. given my study schedule. And then after finishing graduate school in Buddhist studies, I was appointed to teach at Sophia University. So I would go to Kamakura, take the train in the early times, twice a month, and then later on about once a month, and then have two, or sometimes if I couldn't make the other one, at least one session a year with Yamada Roshi until I could complete the Koan curriculum he was in his 80s. Oh no, yeah, when he was about to turn 80, that's when I was at that point of completing the Koan curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about working in passing mu? Was it for some people, passing mu is not that big of a deal. For some people, it's earth shattering. You know, could you convey what your experience was like in that respect?
Oh yeah, that's really something that always stands up in my own recollection of my path. It was just a few weeks since I had met Yamada Koan Roshi in Doksan, and I continued my daily practice and so on. And so I believe I met him in Shoken in October of 1971. Mm-hmm. And so already began practicing with Mu. So at that time, instead of the usual spiritual exercises, we Jesuits were required to or expected to spend at least an hour in contemplative practice. So rather than using the Ignatian methodology at that point, I just incorporated that into my Zen practice and just sat with Mu for an hour a day regularly at that point. So anyway, October, I received that koan. And then there was the Rohatsu session early December, which I could not attend because of my study schedule. But I knew it was going on, and I think my spiritual director was attending that. Or maybe, anyway, that's another thing. But so I was in my room after having sat in formal zazen, and then I transferred to the chair and just sat comfortably on the chair, and then all of a sudden something hit me. And the words that came to me at that point was, "That's me."
It was what?
"That's me." Mm-hmm. All of that talk about Mu and all of those things about infinite and emptiness and so on, somehow it came home. And I jumped out, "Hey, I got it." And so then I immediately jumped with joy and then came out of my room and went to the second floor, knocked on Father Han's door and said, "Hey, I got it, I got it, I got it." So what he said was, "Well, I think you need to call the Roshi now for an appointment for Doksan. They're having Rohatsu now, but maybe they'll let you in just for a Doksan," and so on. So I called the residence and I talked to someone there. I think it may have been Mrs. Yamada, and made an appointment that I would be able to go to Doksan on the following evening. And so I did. And I was able to answer some of the early questions, but then I fumbled on one of the questions, and so he said, Come back tomorrow."
Do you remember which one you fumbled on?
Pardon?
You remember which one you fumbled on?
One or other of those checking questions. I really breezed through most of the early ones, and then it may have been the bell, which I hesitated at, and so on.
Stop the sound of the temple bell, that one?
Correct. Yeah. And so I had to come back one more day, and then the next day it was cleared up, and so on. And so that second day, he already expected that something was coming, so he asked Brigitte Dorci, who was then a German middle-aged lady who had been a teacher in Germany and who then just quit all of her commitments in Germany and came to Japan, fully committed to following and doing Zen with Yamada Roshi. So she was living in an apartment near the Zendo, and so he called her in just to help in translating if there was any need. So anyway, she was there sitting beside him when he checked me, and so he finally said, yes, you have what we call in Zen a Kensho. You have seen the same reality that was seen by Shakyamuni Buddha. So from now on, your practice will be different. Not so much seeking, but now allowing that to settle in and deepen so that you can really live and embody it in your day-to-day life. And so for that, we have these koans that will help you make that more concrete reality in your day-to-day life. So I was given the koan curriculum at that point. And then, so the next spring, 1972, Yasutani Hakun Roshi happened to be visiting during a session. Well, not just visiting, but he was assisting in the retreat because there were more than the usual number. Mm-hmm. So there were days when Yamada Kōun Roshi and Yasutani Roshi exchanged places, where Yasutani Hakun would be given the so-called koan people, the ones who are already doing the koan curriculum, and then Yamada Kōun would take the mu people. So that's how we were. And then there were the Shikantaza people, of course. So okay, now for today, the koan people line up with Yamada Kōun Roshi. Mm-hmm. So for today, and so on. Anyway. So Yamada Kōun Roshi asked me to go to Yasutani Hakun to be checked by him. And so I was given some more checking questions. And when he said, okay, just continue deepening your practice and so on. So I had that opportunity to have also met Yasutani Hakun Roshi in Doksan. And after that, he died in 1973. So within a year, he would come in and visit and be a guest teacher on some of those sessions for that following year. But he was growing weaker, and so he passed on. I think it was in the spring of 1973, or I don't remember exactly what month, but that was the year when he died, and there was a big memorial for him at the Zendo.
Was he a lot different in Dokusan than Yamada was, or did they have a similar style?
He was a little more brusque and more straightforward. Mm-hmm. And Yamada would have a more glowing kind of ambience in listening and in giving instructions. Mm-hmm.
So about your Kensho breakthrough, was there a numinous quality to it, like, or a sacred quality to it, or was it more purely just perceptual, if that question makes sense?
I could say that it was simply a shift, a big shift in seeing things. Mm-hmm. And that shift allowed me to look at things now from a certain standpoint that is like seeing things from within. No longer as objects out there and so on, but so it's somehow a perspective of inner familiarity, you would say. Again, this might sound preposterous or may sound blasphemous, but from a Christian perspective, maybe one could say that it's like looking at the world, looking at the world, looking at yourself from the standpoint of God's eyes. Mm-hmm. Whereby it's a 360-degree angle, not just looking at something and I'm looking at a flower in front of me, like this one that I got for my beloved wife. And Also, looking at things, that photograph out there and so on. It's no longer just me looking at something outside of me, but it's really looking at each and everything from their standpoint. Mm-hmm. That sounds, verbally, it sounds a little unclear, but somehow that's the best way I could describe it. A shift in standpoint from the subjective self to something that embraces us all.
Hmm. Was that a perspective that endured with you, or did it come and go with samadhi or deeper or easier practice?
Well, it's something that, of course, is much clearer on certain occasions, and then it just fades away, although it's always there in the background. Mm-hmm. But there are some moments when it's so clear that there's no doubt about it. And then there are moments when it just recedes into the background, but it does not disappear.
Mm-hmm. So
it's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of familiarity with each and everything.
Mm-hmm. You know, some people might say, you know, it's a feeling of like ultimate safety. Like, you know, there's
no
problem. Yeah.
Correct. You know that, well, in the Christian tradition, there's this Julian of Norwich who is known for having said, "All shall be well. All manner of things shall be well." Mm-hmm. That's really something that resonates deep within. And now we see the world with a lot of suffering. There's Ukraine, and there's the big earthquake in Turkey and Syria and so on. And there's domestic violence, shooting people all around. And there's so much sorrow in this world. And from someone who believes in God in a traditional way, you could ask, how could there be a God and allow all of this to happen? And sometimes I have to say it that way also, because if you believe in a God who is the fixer of all things and yet nothing is fixed, one would be more prone to dismiss such a concept. So yes, dismiss the concept, but then somehow as one enters into this big load of suffering that is the lot of humanity, what's this all about? And yet somehow that assurance comes. Mm-hmm. All shall be well. All manner of things shall be well. Not that there'll be a fix, but somehow, I don't know if I any words from here on will be just kind of misappropriations perhaps, but somehow to see it not in an indifferent way, by the way, don't mistake me for that. The pain is there, and I want to do something about it because it's me also. Mm-hmm. But yet I also know that there are limitations to what I, as an individual person, can do. So I simply trust that it's already being taken care of from somewhere by some others, and I just do my share of whatever I can. So at least I'm left at peace and not always spending sleepless nights worrying about it. Mm-hmm. We have to really worry about it and concern ourselves so that we align our priorities towards the alleviation of all of these things that cause human beings to suffer, especially with the ecological crisis now. That's another thing that's already impinging upon us. So how can we live in a way that we are at least helping out in the alleviation or in the transformation towards sustainability rather than the other way around? So that's a constant task, but mm-hmm. it's not something that makes me anxious to that extent of anxiety. But knowing that it's an urgent task, there's still that level of deep peace that, yes, and it's, I feel that it's that deep peace that can give us precisely the empowerment to address it, not in a frantic kind of way that will just light more fires, but in a way that can hopefully be a calming presence amidst all of this.
Maybe to explain it in an early Buddha analogy, is you're going to get the first dart. Maybe you don't need that second dart.
Right. Indeed. And so, well, I always recall this story of a father walking through a beachhead with a little girl, maybe 3 or 4 years old, just together. And then they come upon this part of the beach where there are thousands of starfish that had been swept by the ocean onto the sand. And now there's the sunlight shining on the starfish. And if they're left there, they would die. So the little girl then sees that and then just jumps up and takes one starfish, throws it back into the water, throws another one. And then, so in a playful kind of way, she just does that. Well, the father says, "Oh, dear, it's useless. See, there are thousands of them. You can't make a difference." But then the little girl says, "Noel, but I can make a difference in this one and in this one and in this one." So that's how I feel, that at least if we do what we can within our own range, there are others who will take care of what needs to be done in other ranges, in other areas. So we trust that I'm not alone. I'm not the savior of the world, but I can at least help and align my resources in that direction rather than be an obstacle or rather than be someone who is indifferent to it.
Mm-hmm. So you were going through the koan curriculum. Did you, so you did it and then you did the miscellaneous koans, presumably.
Correct.
And then, so then you did the Mumon Khan and.
Yes, Mumon Khan and then the Blue Cliff Records.
Did you notice that the nature of the koans changed as you're going through the curriculum? Oh,
yes, that's right.
That a little bit?
Mm-hmm. So in any case, the koans, in fact, the miscellaneous koans have some kind of depth to them. And so you think they should be the simpler ones, but not at all. Well, they're simple in a sense that it's simply many of them are just one sentence or a couple of lines, but they already are introducing us to the depths of Zen. And then with the Mumon Khan, that's another very, very well-chosen group that also leads to an experiential jolt done correctly. And then somehow the Blue Cliff Records, they also are in that alignment. But so the difference is that in the Mumon Khan, well, we also do the verses. We look at the verses and also offer a presentation. And that somehow completes the picture of each koan. Mm-hmm. In the Blue Cliff and in the Book of Tranquility, it's just the case. So we omit the verses and we omit the introductory part. So we just go straight to the point. Mm-hmm. But as I noticed in many of the later ones, like in the Shoyo Roku or Book of Tranquility, somehow, I don't know whether others would agree with me in looking at this, but there are a lot of not that deep koans that can just be seen through if you've been through the others. No big deal. So sometimes I just say to a student, okay, that's not that difficult. Let's go to the next one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in kind of our shared sub-tradition, you know, we have the Shoyo Ruko and, the Book of Tranquility, and then Keizan's Transmission of Light.
Yes.
So do you think that's not in the Rinzai tradition that Harada Roshi inherited? Do you think he came up with the answers he expected there? Like, have you heard any stories on how those came about? Or was it Yasudarni?
You mean the Denko Roku? You mean the transmission?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, well, each of them would have their own unique twist. There are some that really can test you whether you really touch rock bottom. And there are those that are just repetitive. Once you have a certain frame of mind to be able to understand and present what a koan is asking for, then somehow they follow a certain pattern. Mm-hmm. But again, there are verses there in the Denko Roku or in the Book of Transmission that can be very deeply transformative also if you are able to get into the right spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I've listed them down so that when sometimes I'm asked by other Zen teachers or Dharma brothers and sisters to take on a student of theirs who has finished their program. And they said, well, just to get the taste of another teacher. So I choose some of those that I feel can be a little more tasty and transformative among these koans. And so it's really fun to go through with these with students who have gone through the whole thing, and you can now really check and go deep rather than just look for the correct answer.
Mm-hmm. I know in Henry Schuchman's book, was it One Blade of Grass, I think he called
One Blade of Grass, correct.
He talked about how after he finished the koan curriculum with his teachers, they sent him, he was kind of sent to you and you guys went through him again.
Exactly, yes.
Were you exploring them at different levels, or how does that work?
We didn't go through the whole thing, but we went, oh yeah, maybe we did. Yeah,
In the book, he says you went through the whole thing, I think.
Yes.
Maybe a couple times
even. He came and stayed in our house, and so we would go through them. We'd spend a couple of hours that just going from one to the other and so on, and then take a rest, have lunch, then go to the next set and so on. Yes, we did that. Now I remember. Mm-hmm. And yet, there are some really that can be very explosive again. It can bring you back to that original experience that led us to this whole opening in the first place. So yes, I really enjoyed working on some of these koans with Henry. And for Henry, he's so very, very open, so that his laughter would resound. If he gets something, and he would just laugh and fill the room, and I could not help but laugh with him also. There were several instances of that, and it's really, it was really fun to go through some of them.
Mm-hmm. At what point did Yamada Roshi talk to you about him wanting you to be a teacher?
Well, he never really talked about it in a sense, because when I was already finished with the koans, I kept going for review and so on. And then he died.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mrs. Yamada called me sometime later and said, oh, your name is Kei Un. He has a document for you with all of the things. And so she was very, very, it was only several months after he had passed on when they finally got all of his things together. And he had scrolls with different names of those whom he, with the names of those whom he appointed teacher. Mm-hmm. And we were all notified later on. And there was a ceremony held at San Unzendo in January or so after he died in 1989, I believe. It was January 1990. So I was already here in Dallas. And so I got the phone call and was very pleased and glad and grateful. But I could not fly into Kamakura at that point because I already had my teaching schedule here. So they just did it by proxy in my absence, and so I got the scroll by mail later, or somebody had brought it to me. Mm-hmm. Somebody who was coming from Japan and was passing by gave it to me later.
Oh, I meant to ask you earlier, speaking of ceremonies, were they still doing the Kensho recognition ceremony? And did you go through that? And if so, what do you think about those ceremonies?
I have not done that at all in the community that I guide, because it makes people somehow differentiated into the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. And somehow that distracts from the sense of community in practice. So I have been discreet, and I would not even announce who had Kensho or not, but I just let them continue, and they're not supposed to tell anybody.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, so as a teacher, what are your standards for passing someone through Mu? Are you looking simply for someone who can answer the questions? Are you looking for an inner transformation, or like what?
That already leads me to that. It's not so much answering the questions, but a transformative experience whereby I could see that this person is now seeing things from a different perspective than the egoic self. Mm-hmm. Somebody could go and answer the questions straight on, like somebody would have read Joel Hoffman's book, The Son of One Hand, could come up with those answers, but you could see it in the way they respond. So I usually would have other side questions to confirm whether that's something that's coming from experience or not. Mm-hmm. So that's what I look for, truly transformative experience that can change a person's way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. That's what Zen is for, in fact.
Are you looking for a deep experience, or is like just an intimation enough to move forward, do you think?
Even a shift in perspective is enough to start with, and mm-hmm. then hopefully as we work together, it gets deeper and deeper. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things, by the way, one of the things that I remember in San Unzendo, one of the things that Yamada Kon Roshi said at some point. So when I started sitting there in the 1970s, and it was still the very, very militaristic style that you can see in Three Pillars of Zen. Mm-hmm. A lot of shouts during the Zendo, like the sergeant, or no, I mean, Miyazaki Roshi was the one who had the stick and so on. That they would always give encouragements like shouting in the Zendo, Rinzai style, like, don't relent, just say, and so on. We would get that kind of loud encouragement. Mm-hmm. And at the end of a session, or rather toward the last day, on the night before the session was to end, the next morning, there was always this all night sit. And so people were encouraged to sit all night because then they could enter into a deep state of samadhi whereby they would get it, and then they would have doksan the next morning, and they would have the answers to the questions about mu and so on. Mm-hmm. And so there were, in fact, people who did sit all night, and somehow the answers came to them and they were passed, and then they were paraded around. Mm-hmm. Then that was for the first decade or so that I was sitting regularly at San Unzendo. Then somehow in the 80s, Yamada Kon Roshi began he said that what is important is not so much to get the answer and then try to do your koans. What's important is to really build upon your practice and embody it in your life so that you can attain a depth, so that when it comes to you, then you can really say it with that groundedness and that conviction. And mm-hmm. he said, those who get it after an all-night sit somehow tend to be rather shallow. He said that publicly. And I don't know whether he was looking at anybody there, but so he said. And so for those who have been through that, for example, there are some, and I can name, maybe I forgot their names, but there were some individuals who had been working towards getting mu, and when they finally got it, they felt, now I've gotten it, so I don't need to practice anymore. And mm-hmm. so that's a tendency that can happen to some of those who only get it in that kind of
pressure cooker.
Yeah, pressure cooker kind of way. That's a great word.
Yeah.
But Yamada Roshi said, really, it's years and years of regular sitting whereby you deepen your state of samadhi, and then you realize that world that had been there all right from the start. So it's just a natural way of sliding into it. Mm-hmm. So he said, some people might find an explosive experience, but there are some also who just have a little, now I see. And then they find a deep peace as an assurance. So not all has that kind of explosive, transformative experience. The transformation can occur in a more quiet and more gentle way inside a person.
Yeah. On that topic, a pattern that a lot of people seem to follow is, you know, they have their first initial kind of intimation, and then a deeper, more, you know, almost like a death and rebirth type experience later. Right. Some people have the experience, and then it's more, they never have like the huge big bang death and rebirth later, but it's a kind of a gradual,
right,
kind of, you know, walking through the mist type experience. Do you think they're both valid paths, or do you think you need that like really powerful death and rebirth?
I can't judge. I feel that if one continues in a sustained way of practice, and that one's life and perspective are duly transformed by it so that one can really cultivate a compassionate heart and a heart that is truly one with the realities of the world in a way that responds to it, then the other things that come with it are just secondary things. For some it may come as a second explosive part. For some it may just be a gradual deepening and transformation. So attunement. Right, what did you say?
An attunement.
Attunement, exactly. That's a great word, attunement, a greater and greater attunement. But somehow that deep realization, I feel, is really just part of the process. It's not a big bang anymore, but you somehow also can get those jolts and be confirmed that you've known that all along.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, Dogen, saying is often translated as practice enlightenment, but if you actually look at the words, it's practice and confirmation, or practice
and validation. So it's confirmation, that's right. Also yeah. Enlightenment and confirmation and confirmation, that's right.
So to get it back to the biographical aspect a little bit, so at some point you decided not to be a celibate Jesuit priest.
Yes.
Where was that process along in your Zen journey?
I had been toward the latter part of my Koan practice. I was almost finished with the Koan curriculum. Mm-hmm. What happened was I fell in love for the second time.
This is someone you met in Japan?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was this German scholar who was doing research on Kuan Yin, and so she attended a conference that I happened to be asked to pinch hit in giving a paper. Mm-hmm. And so we started talking about common things. She also grew up in a Catholic family, but now had been practicing Zen under Yamada Kohn Roshi's guidance. Father Enomiya LaSalle's guidance. Father Enomiya LaSalle is one of Yamada Kohn's early students also, whom he gave the authorization to be a teacher of Zen. So he had been giving retreats in Germany in Zen. So she had been to one of those retreats and wanted to continue. So now that Father LaSalle was in Japan, where she was also, she would go to his retreats. And so we talked about Zen. She was just beginning and she had just been given Mu. Our conversations turned to a gradual deepening friendship. And within a year or so, the friendship developed into something more than friendship on my part. I was getting to be enamored by her and so on. But then I realized, I'm supposed to be celibate. What do I do now? So my question then at that point was, how do you solve the problem of Maria? That was her name, by the way. She's named Maria. And so I had to really look at this. She was the one who first told me, you can't go on meeting like this. So she was really very serious and said, and as long as you're a celibate priest and so on, vow to your service in the church, then it's awkward to continue in this way. It'll just, and so on. So she was the first one who gave me that word. And so that made me stop and really realize, you're right. So I needed to come to terms with who I was, who I am, and what the future was for me, whether to just say, thank you, it was good to meet you, but we have to stop meeting now, goodbye, or whether there was another way. Mm-hmm. So that I had to, I went on a semester's leave from my teaching in Sofia. That was the spring of 1989, and went back to the Philippines, went on retreat there, and then consulted with my Jesuit friends and also family and other friends. And somehow I came to terms with the fact that this love that had been nourished in my life now, that had been introduced into my life now, it's not something that I can just set aside and ignore, but it's inviting me to move on, move forward, and take this on in a serious way.
Did your Jesuit superiors try to talk you out of leaving?
In fact, no. When I talked to the spiritual director, who was my master of novices when I entered, or the second one came, when I talked to him and I said, "This is my dilemma, Father. I met this young woman and I feel attracted to her now, and yet I also want to be faithful to my vows as a Jesuit and continue to serve the church as a Jesuit." So that was really the dilemma. So then he asked me, "But what do you want?" And immediately it came, "I want to be with her." Mm-hmm. So that was a deep, deep voice from my heart. So that with that, then that's where God is leading you. So because that's one of the Ignatian principles also. That longing deep in your heart is something instilled there by God. So follow that and see what you need to do to let that flourish. So somehow he followed that principle, although that meant that I would be having to ask for dispensation from my vows and have to leave the Jesuits, have to leave my job, have to leave Japan because my visa was incumbent upon my being assigned there by the Jesuits with nowhere in sight. So, and yet I felt a deep peace that this is what I needed to do.
Mm-hmm. So, and you already talked to her that, you know, are we going to be together if I leave, or did you leave the priesthood not even knowing if there was the option of a relationship?
We talked, and I told her, and she was also agreeable, that we need to distance ourselves from one another for a year or so that mm-hmm. I can discern without being duly attached. And you can also discern whether you want to join me if that will be my choice. So we chose to be apart for a year. And so in that regard, we respected one another. We, of course, communicated by letter and by occasional phone calls during that time. But at least that, so that it's not, if I leave, will you marry me? No, leave first and then we'll decide.
Right.
To be the thing. So that it was something that was totally integral and freedom, not based on the condition of anything, of any expectation. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was at that point when an invitation letter came from the Dean of Perkins School of Theology, where I'm teaching now, to come for a year first. And they said, "Come on over, teach this course because we have somebody on leave that we need a replacement for. And after a year or so, let's talk." And we did. And so they got stuck with me ever since. And so then we got Maria, then also had to decide. Her family, her mother went on a hunger strike when she found out that she was thinking of marrying this Jesuit, saying, "You'll drag him down to hell and you'll get dragged down there too. So stop that silliness."
She was a Catholic, her mother.
Yes, exactly. Well, very, very devout Catholics. Mm-hmm. So she had to leave the house for a while to let things cool down and then made her own discernment. She asked several people also. She was given different kinds of advice. So the advice that she was given that she followed was, well, check it out. Go to Dallas and see how things are there and whether you can live there and live with him or not. Well, find out for yourself. So she did. She came in December of 1989 when I was already here. I came here in August of 89, started teaching. Mm-hmm. And so she came and then she went back. After she came after Christmas, I believe, and then went back after a week or so, having seen Dallas. And Dallas was in a deep freeze then. It was below zero and snowing and everything. So she realized, oh, it snows here too. It's cold here too. Mm-hmm. So she felt, maybe I can live here. And so with that assurance, she came back in March to join me, and we got married in April of 1990. Mm-hmm. She also continued her practice, and first with Father LaSalle and then with Yamada Cohen, and then after that, then she continued her practice with me, and then she went to other teachers. Mm-hmm. And is also an authorized Zen teacher by Yamada Ryōun, the son of Yamada Kōun. Mm-hmm. She teaches Zen on her own in another community in South Bend, Indiana. And she also helps and with her Buddhist master, who is a Chan master in Taiwan. And she's, mm-hmm. in fact, there now for a few weeks doing retreat with him.
Interesting. So I want to address a little bit about the dichotomy of being a Buddhist Christian. I'm sure this is something you've been asked about a lot. Yeah. So I recently read the Pat Hock biography. Are you familiar? Did you know Pat Hock?
Oh, yes. Huh. I have. What did he write?
There's a biography about him called Open Sky.
I haven't read that. I don't know. I need to check it out.
Yeah, really good book. I'd recommend it. Anyway, and I was kind of curious in the book if they would address, you know, how he reconciled his Christian faith with his Buddhist practices. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like he just didn't reconcile it. You know, I mean, he did say at one point, you know, he was reported in the book to say that he didn't believe in an afterlife. So in that sense, you know, you could almost maybe say he was a secular Buddhist, you know.
I see.
He did the Christian contemplation retreats, and then he did Zen Sashin. Right. He didn't mix them at all.
Right. He got that from one of his teachers, Willigis Jaeger, who was a Benedictine, who also was asked to leave by his superiors because they could not, the superiors could not reconcile him being a Zen teacher and a Benedictine priest and monk at the same time. So he said, you have to choose. So he chose Zen. And so he left the Benedictine order. And I think that was one of the pains in his life. Mm-hmm. On for another 10, maybe 15 years after that. But he continued to find a great following and many supported him. But he made a very clear-cut distinction or difference between what he would say is this Zen, and then he would say, then this retreat is for Christian contemplation. Mm-hmm. So there were a few who were in both, but generally they were two separate ways in which he guided people in contemplative practice. Mm-hmm.
The book is called Across the Empty Sky, a biography of Patrick Hock, Catholic priest.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and who's the author?
Let's see here. Wait one sec. Helen Amerengen.
Okay, I will check that out. Okay. Right after this, I'll order that.
Yeah, Across the Empty Sky. I can send you a link too.
Thank you.
So in your own life, like, so in a lot of ways, you know, Zen is precognitive, you know, it's all about experience. You know, Catholics, you know, like Meister Eckhart clearly had that same dynamic in his life, you know, looking at his readings, like, you know, he could easily have been a Zen master, you know, in a different mm-hmm. context. And so like experientially there, you know, there's not that much dichotomy, I think, between, it's not even tied to a religion. However, you know, when you get to like cosmological elements of the, you know, like in Christianity, you know, at least many Christians believe, you know, you're judged based on your behavior while your life, and then you either go to heaven or hell, or maybe there's a purgatory, you know, whereas, you know, a religious Buddhist would view, you know, you're transmigrated through various realms and existences, and karma is a real phenomenon. I mean, do you feel any conflict there, or like, how do you resolve this in your own life?
There are a lot of cultural accretions, both in Christianity as well as in Buddhism, that are totally different from one another. Mm-hmm. And so I've been struggling with this over the years, and it must have taken me about 10 years to really find peace with being able to say, are you Christian? I would like to live according to the way that Jesus taught and would like to live fully as a Christian. And then when I'm asked, are you Buddhist? I also would like to live according to the path of the Buddha and live fully in that life of awakening. Mm-hmm. For me, I don't feel there's a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. Now, regarding specific beliefs, I'm still at work on articulating what this entails for me as a Christian, and to be also fully able to say that's also a possible statement that a Buddhist can say. Mm-hmm. I'm still working at it. But in terms of the basics, I don't see any conflict anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, regarding reincarnation and heaven and so on, I respectfully have a level of, I mean, I would like to implore the freedom of unknowing. Mm-hmm. Openness. I will not deny, neither will I affirm one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Like truly agnostic.
Exactly. A religious agnostic in that regard, but open. Mm-hmm. For example, I recite the creed with full conviction that it's there. But for example, the difference in one form of creed, one version of the creed reads, I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the resurrection of the body, and life everlasting. Amen. Each and every phrase of that is something I can fully affirm with the theological understanding that I am able to articulate from a Zen perspective. And that's one of my hopes also, to be able to do that sooner or later after I step down from my day job. Mm-hmm. Now I can also affirm the Four Noble Truths and the Three Marks of Dharma and all of the things about the Bodhisattva vows and so on. And I can recite Namu Amida Butsu also and so on in a way that does not contradict what I believe in as a Christian. Mm-hmm. So that's something that needs to be really fleshed out in given conversations with individual people who have some theological questions about it. So I'm willing to sit down and work out how I can consistently be able to say, I would like to be fully a Christian, and also I hope that I'm also living fully the Buddhist path as I understand it and as other people understand it. But for me, the liberating thing about being a Zen Buddhist is that principle that Zen does not rely on words or concepts, mm-hmm. but is transmitted from heart to heart or mind to mind, from teacher to disciple. And so that's what I have received in confidence, which I would like to continue to preserve and convey in a way that is true to the Zen spirit and true to the spirit of Buddhism. Mm-hmm.
On that topic, do you have any Dharma heirs? Oh, Valerie's your Dharma heir, right?
Valerie, yes. Valerie Forsman is. Mm-hmm. And several others. The ones that I have appointed now are Helen Cortez, who is now teaching with me at the Maria Kannon Zen Center. And also, of course, my beloved spouse, Maria, is also someone whom I have conferred that authorization. And mm-hmm. then the other one is Lois Imbrogno. And there are several more coming. Oh, yes, Leanne Nail, who is teaching in Salem, Oregon, is another one who mm-hmm. has gone through the Koan program with me, and I have given her that mandate to continue the Dharma. Mm-hmm.
And if my understanding is, in the Sambo Zen lineage, you guys kind of get provisional authorization and they become an assistant teacher, but then they have another authorization with the abbot. Is that correct?
That is something that was put into the system by Yamada Kon's successor, Kubota Roshi. Mm-hmm. For Kubota Roshi, when he realized that Yamada Kon had authorized all of these gaijin, all of these foreigners, he was kind of concerned that whether they actually have what it takes. And so he then divided them into those three rungs. Mm-hmm. Okay, those who were appointed by Yamada Kon are teachers, but then we'll have the prerogative as now the abbot of Sambo Zen to appoint associate Zen masters and then full Zen masters. But for Yamada Kōen Roshi, there was no such gradation. Those he appointed as teachers had the full authorization as teachers. Mm-hmm. How I understand it, and it was Kubota who made those hierarchical divisions, and then that's how we continue with it with Yamada Ryōen Roshi. So there are two or three who are now named as full Shōshike or full Zen masters, and then there's a bunch of us who are on that associate master level, and then there are the Zen teachers. But in my understanding from Yamada's heritage, as long as one has been given the authorization as a Zen teacher, then one can start off one's own lineage and so on, although one, of course, belongs to the larger community. Mm-hmm. And there have been such teachers who have been given that authorization as teachers who have left off, like there's an Indian Jesuit priest named Amasami, mm-hmm. who has left the Sambo Zen, but continues with his authorization from Yamada Kōen, and so on.
Yeah, of course, Robert Aiken and the Daiden Sangha and so forth.
Correct. Well, he asked for that, the whole shebang, so he got it from Yamada Kōen before he died. So he was one of those who got all of the full authorization. But in that regard, yes, he was in the same circle as we were.
Mm-hmm. When you are you ever in a situation where you kind of inherit Daimon Sangha or like Aiken Roshi lineage students and you start working with them, does it seem like the Kōen curriculums are similar, or are they?
Oh, yeah, it's the same Kōen curriculum.
But as far as the expected responses or presentations?
Well, I have my expected responses, and whatever they have said in the other one, well, that's fine, but let's see whether you can actually come up with whatever transformation.
They can differ.
Yes, exactly. Well, I expect a certain way of responding in a way that indicates a transformation, even if they've passed with other teachers. Or here's another thing. Some who are now on the second round with me, even if they passed in their first level, and now I also, by the way, grew in my own understanding of some of these koans. And when I was early on in teaching, I would have passed some easily. And now I've seen a depth to some of these koans that I would like to impart to those who come to Doksan with me. So I'd like to. So even though they may have passed the first round, I try to give them a deeper angle, and so I'm not that easy anymore in passing people with koans.
You know, it's funny. I was recently kind of organizing my koan notes, mm-hmm. and looking at past koans I've done, like, you know, even two years ago or whatever. And mm-hmm. I noticed like a few of them that I passed, but I realized in retrospect I didn't really get it.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. Like, you know, like now, like looking back, I'm like, oh, well, that's what, like. Like, I intuitively kind of knew the right answer, but right. I didn't really, like, it wasn't really in my bones, you know? And, like, but and looking back, I was surprised at, like, what a fresh view I had on them compared to when I went through them, you know?
Right. There you go. Indeed. So we grow on them. And even now, I'm growing and deepening in my understanding of these koans as I work on them with individuals. And sometimes I see something new that I just passed somebody, but then the next one, I'll have to be a little more demanding as to whether they see this other angle that I just saw recently. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Yeah, I'm always so impressed at how artfully, ingeniously the koans are designed. I mean, they're not,
indeed.
I mean, they're just so, like, really was spiritual geniuses that came up with them.
Really,
I mean, it's amazing how subtle they can be.
We really bow in deep gratitude to all of those who formulated these koans. Yeah. Yeah, they pack so much wealth in them. If we could only really mine them, really, it's mm-hmm. It's so rich and so full, indeed. Mm-hmm. Good. I think we're going a little. People are getting bored with this conversation of ours now. It's
okay. Let's wrap it up then. Hey, I had a quick question before we go. Sure. So your sangha now, is it largely Christians and practitioners, or is it a mix?
I don't ask.
Okay.
But many are Christian and continue to be so. Others are what you could call spiritual, but not religious. Mm-hmm. Some others want to be explicitly Buddhist, who want to take the precepts and so on. So
do you offer Jukai to your students? Is that an option?
No, it's not Jukai, but we take the precepts at the last part of the koan curriculum.
Okay.
We're given the so-called Jukai, not in a public ceremony, but in that private ceremony between teacher and student. So we finish the koan curriculum with that Jukai from the teacher. But then in the last 10 years or so, Yamada Ryōen Roshi, the successor, who is now abbot, has now instituted Jukai for those senior students and teachers who want. So I did receive my own raksu in that regard. So I can also give that, but it doesn't seem to be necessary. And so that's another level of training that some people want, but others generally don't anyway. So those who want Jukai, I tell them, well, there's a Soto teacher who's willing to take you on and who will guide you in that. So please check this out. And so that I welcome that.
Cool. So if someone wanted to get a hold of you, what would be the best mechanism? Through the Maria Kanon website? And the reason I ask is I know someone who tried to reach out to you through the website and never heard back. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's can be very iffy.
Yeah.
So my email is the best way, rhabito@smu.edu.
Okay.
Good.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
A pleasure.
Okay. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
Talk with you again from here on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.